Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It's coming to the end of November 2017. A few preliminaries to get out of the way. Number one, I want to thank my donors. Some of you have been very generous. You know this is what I do. I'm a professional scholar in this field. I don't have, nor could I have, a normal job. This is what I do full time. And I asked my friends to donate proportional to what they've learned here. And especially my tax situation now has gotten me into some trouble because I refuse to take a tax exemption from this regime because of the control that it would put on me. So as always, I ask for your assistance. You can go to my website, rusjournal.org, rusjournal.org, and I have a donation button on there. And also, you know, you get my books from there, and all my essays are on there, and things like that. The second thing is that I had a lecture scheduled at the first week in December at Jordanville, the seminary in upstate New York. It was canceled by the new the dean up there, the absolute execrable Alexander Webster. He's an OCA Zionist and neocon who I've fought very publicly in the past. I heckled one of his sermons at St. Mary's, very liberal Antiochian church in Chambersburg, PA, over these issues. He's in such favor of these wars for liberalism abroad that his vestments actually were made of the desert camouflage kind of fabric. And I attacked him for that and a bunch of other things. And when he realized that it was me, he had it canceled. So those in the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, there are a lot of good people there, mostly good people there, but the joining with the Moscow Patriarch came at a huge price. Not only did you lose half your members, but you now have to take orders from people like him. I say nothing different. In fact, most of what I say comes directly from the former dean of that seminary, the Archbishop Averke of Jordanville in upstate New York. And he is pounding on the inside of the lid of his coffin as we speak what's being done at that institution, that Webster, who founded his parish in Woodbridge, Virginia, as a liberal alternative to Father George Kalku, church, which is right up the street in Alexandria on Route 7, was at one time, considering him too anti-Semitic and anti-communist. Alex Webster founded his so-called Romanian Orthodox parish in Woodbridge, Virginia. And that's how we first met. That's how we first fought. But having him run that seminary is an insult, because he is everything that Archbishop Averke hated. And it's really a mockery of that institution. The third thing I want to get out of the way, and this week I'm going to do a Daily Traditionalist on this subject, or at least partially on this subject. That is a new Thor movie. You guys have seen this, Ragnarok. And it was shocking. I wasn't expecting this at all. I mean, I know Hollywood sucks and everything, but this has gone way beyond it. Essentially, this is a call for white genocide. I mean, just a very, very brief description. Thor's older sister takes over once the king has been killed. That is, Odin. Okay, now that right there should send up all kinds of red flags. She's a good guy, of course, but is not portrayed that way. She notices that there's been a lot of propaganda near the end of Odin's reign of this new liberal order in his elderly state. And she actually tears down all of the new paintings and things that are, you know, icons and things, and shows the truth underneath, that these things have been painted over. And so you automatically see that she's a traditionalist, and she uses the eternal flame to resurrect the elders and the soldiers of the old order. Now Thor is sent into exile. He's castrated. His hammer is destroyed, and his hair is cut. Big deal for him. So in order to take back Asgard, he puts together a coalition of every alien race in the universe. And yeah, it is what you think. Castrated Thor has very little power. And the way that they take Asgard, which is just the essence of Scandinavia, is to destroy it. They call upon a demon, clearly a satanic image, to burn Asgard to the ground, just as the Riders are doing right now. He is put in charge of this very, very unstable coalition, but certainly can't control it. He calls on this demon to destroy even the foundations, and that's made very explicit, of Asgard. And they say explicitly that the new Asgard is going to be a haven for all the races throughout the galaxy. And you watch it burn, and they escape in this ship, and they say, we're going to build anew on this multicultural foundation. That even the foundations of Asgard have been destroyed by them calling upon a demon. They're so obsessed with destroying the old order, as Odin had been killed, and his elder sister, who actually did have a right to the throne, takes over, exposes a fraud of the liberal order that Odin in his declining years had put in place, and is trying to maintain some kind of central, she's the last gasp of the old order. And the only way that she can be defeated is to call this monstrous demon to destroy the entire place. Now, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that this is about the invasion of Scandinavia by these migrants and burning the place to the ground for the sake of starting anew. And I'm telling you, it's a lot worse than that if you were to go see this. But I want to talk about this more some other time. But I was absolutely shocked by seeing this. It was so blatant. There's no real symbols because everything is out in the open. And they actually say this is going to be a new order where all races of the universe can come and find protection or solace or whatever it is. They're not being shy. This is about the destruction of Scandinavia. And Hollywood is admitting that this is what's going on over there. And they call on this demon that's given the power to destroy Asgard or Scandinavia. That's the essence of Scandinavia, the old order. And it's made very clear that his elder sister is in the right. She's a little on the harsh side. But in tearing down the new pictures and showing the real ones underneath, she's depicted as having the truth. This is all propaganda. The new liberal orders is propaganda. So they're not being shy here. They're talking about the complete destruction of Scandinavia through a completely neutered and totally neutralized Thor. Doesn't have, he cut his hair and his hammer is destroyed. So he needs all these aliens. And if this were a real situation, those aliens would overthrow him using Loki, of course, at the first opportunity. Because he is too close to the old order. They're going to destroy him, probably overthrow him, and rule alone. So, I know I shouldn't be shocked, but this is one that's just, it's so blatant that I want to talk about it, and I want to talk about it some more at another time. But it is, it was extremely, I was very shaken as I came out of the theater. Anyway, today, I want to talk about, I have a new book coming out. It's a set of essays on revisionist history concerning the Soviet Union. And one of the sections is Soviet ideology, Western delusion, and the Russian Orthodox Church in the USSR. And I want to deal with this right now. It's going to be the subject of my talk tonight. And one of the things I deal with is the so-called writings of Patriarch Tikhon Bulavin. And there's a lot of controversy about this because there are things that are clearly fakes that are included in his writings. Now, Tikhon, of course, is Saint Tikhon now, was a powerful voice against the Red Takeover in the middle of the Russian Civil War. He had a ruthless red enemy, divisions in his own church, white forces whose ideology was totally non-existent, and a country that had been brutalized into insensitivity. Tikhon accepted the office of patriarch in 1918. He was the first man to hold that title since 1701. And he was an American citizen at one time. Between 1898 and 1907, he was Bishop of Alaska and also in New York. Now, GPU, the Soviet documents dated October 31st, 1922, make it very clear that Tikhon is an enemy to be fought. And one of the ways that the Cheka and the Soviets are going to do this is by creating sectarianism, to sow dissent within the church itself. And it's repeated in a document 1 year later. Now, there was a time when speaking like this would get you into a lot of trouble. You'd be called a conspiracy nut, whatever. But now, it's public record. And now historians are talking about it like they believed it all along. June 13th, 1928, the GPU recommends increasing support for sectarian groups, especially the Dokhobors. Any division possible. And don't forget, they created their own conservative Orthodox group, the Gregorians. These aren't just liberal sectarians, these are conservative sectarians as well, all under Soviet control. Now, there's a few documents that allegedly have been written by Tikhon, and it's really easy to show that they're fakes. Sometimes they are considered genuine and are thrown in the face of traditionalists, saying that, you know, Tikhon supported the Soviet system, just like Sergius did. And you can tell it's a fake because it's made up of ideological cliches that any, you know, pseudo-Marxist would throw out there in any conversation. Something that he would never say and something that he really didn't have the vocabulary to say. And he says he's apologizing for his previous positions on things because he was a product of a monarchical society. And so he's apologizing. It's something that he would never say. He was a royalist himself. And it's something that certainly the GPU would have him say. Because there is no such thing as monarchical society. That was a form of government, but certainly not a society. And then, of course, he obliges them, and he accepts all state action against anti-Soviet elements in Russian life. And then, this alleged document from Tikhon, he says that the whites are identical to monarchists. But even a cursory glance at the writings of the major leaders of the white faction show a dedication to Kerensky and the basic, liberal position, so-called cadet position. The very reference to a white movement is absurd because, historically speaking, there is no such thing. The writing in this document is stilted and bureaucratic. And yet, this didn't prevent the majority of Russia experts, right up until the late 80s, from accepting it without criticism, showing how little they know about the subject that they get so much money and salary to understand. Now, as time goes on, it gets a bit more sophisticated. That this person, Patriarch Tikhon, that the GPU is writing on his behalf, you read these documents that he allegedly wrote supporting the Soviet state, and it seems to be more than one person. It sounds like different parts of it were written by different functionaries. July 1st, 1923, for example. He's said to have written a condemnation of the renovationists and foreign involvement in Russian religious life. Now, he did actually say this. So that's true. But then they mix it with a lie, because they say he's allegedly said that Russian monarch or white monarchists are to be condemned, as well as a synod abroad, the Kolobsky Synod, soon to be known as the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia or in exile. It's odd. It seems to be inconsistent, largely because the Synod of Metropolitan Antony that he's referring to is certainly monarchist, but the whites certainly were not. And it's kind of crazy to think that Tikhon would make that error twice. Now, on the 15th, that same year, the same month, he writes an article allegedly condemning the renovationists. On the 23rd of August, he also adds the monarchists to this, as well as a ridiculous notion that the USSR is from God and blessed by God. Now, these three documents read as a very clumsy way to add authenticity to the writing by including condemnation of the renovationists, or the renovators, who we did truly condemn. But the GPU had rejected the renovationists anyway by this time. Mentioning Polish interference, for example, in Russian life is predictable, since this was at the conclusion of the Polish-Soviet War. Rejecting these on those grounds is certainly makes it quite certain. Then he says that the new calendar cannot be imposed by the state or the Senate without the consent of the people. He says that at one time, and he did legitimately say that. But now, September 30th, 1924, another document written by him allegedly, he says that the new calendar should be immediately imposed. And this clumsy writer, whoever it is, says that there's great support for the calendar change among Russians. The smoking gun, that it's not him. It's a statement that, he says, ignorance and fanaticism is keeping Russia from accepting this bold reform. The important thing to note, other than the fact that it obviously wasn't him, historians specializing in Russia and the revolution have believed these to be legitimately his writing for a long time. And it shows you that they cannot be trusted. They're such clumsy forgeries, using the ideological cliches that all of these Marxists used at the time. It clearly is not him. It contradicts everything else he ever said. But they don't really know the ideology of the Russian state and Russian society. They know it only through caricature. Therefore, they don't know what a forgery would be, because I have nothing to compare it to. Now, one of the bigger issues is the so-called Testament, a Patriarch Tikhon from April 7th, 1925. Now, I dismiss it. Most of it is a poorly written fraud. But the GPU, the Cheka Communist Party, is getting better. Now, I'm going to quote something here. It's a lengthy quotation. And I've translated this, and any errors here are my own. Let me read this. Coming to power over Russia, representatives of the Soviet authority in January of 1918 issued an edict guaranteeing the complete freedom of Soviet citizens to believe what they wish. This means the principle of freedom of conscience is enshrined in the Constitution of the USSR, and it provides every religious group, including our own Orthodox Church, with the right and freedom to conduct its religious affairs in accordance with the requirements of their conscience, so long as it doesn't violate public order and the rights of other citizens. Because of this, we write to the archpastors and pastors of our flock to fully accept and to acknowledge the new order of things, the workers' and peasants' government of the people. This government has been welcomed by the people. It's time to realize the Christian view that the destiny of God's people are being built together and accept everything that has happened as an expression of God's will. We will not sin against the faith in the church by not meddling with these issues. We will permit no compromises or concessions in the area of faith and its civic expression. We should be sincere with or respect for the Soviet government as an expression of the common good. We should adjust our church life to the new order of state and, in so doing, condemn every group that opposes this new order and any campaigns against it. That's the end of the quote. This is found at the beginning of his so-called testament. And of course, it's obviously not him. The Patriarch of the Russian Church, a royalist, is not going to say anything like this. It's nothing but one Marxist cliche after another after another. This is what a GPU operative might think Tikhon would say. But it's definitely mixed. Different factions of the Communist Party added their own cliches to this. The scholar has to know the ideology of Marx and Lenin, those who were promoting it in the USSR, as well as the hierarchy of the Russian church and what they would actually say about these kind of things. Once you know all this, the cliches in these missives are easily exposed. And they're really second-rate versions of official propaganda. Again, it shows you how bad the academics have been and continue to be in the Anglo-American liberal historians. None of them are really conversant of the Orthodox philosophy, the ideological spectrum of the Soviet Union. Since philosophy, theology, politics, economics, history, they're all artificially separated in academia. Using only one of these disciplines exclusively can't help but lead to a distorted view of things, really. Marx has to be understood in detail. Then the malformations of his doctrine by lower-level functionaries make more sense. You have to know all of these things in detail before you can even dare pass judgment on these things. It just shows you how bad the situation is in academics, because they truly believe this to be Tikhon. It's so clumsy. And when he's writing something, it's nothing but cliches, typical of the time, you know it can't be true. First of all, the church in Russia has normally defined politics as the daily grind of elections, you know, party factions, backroom deals, bureaucratic ladder climbing. When they condemn politics, they're not condemning questions of justice or ethics. They have political implications. They're not essentially political questions. Now, if by politics someone means opposing the Soviet state, and it's a deliberate manipulation of words, given the circumstances, it's definitely the latter. Let me quote something else from this forgery. The public acts of our Orthodox community should not be directed towards politics, which is completely alien to the Church of God. It should be directed towards the strengthening of the faith to fight the enemies of Orthodoxy, sectarians, Catholics, Protestants, renovators, atheists, and all like them who use their energy to attack Orthodoxy. The enemies of the Church have resorted to all kinds of deceptive tactics, using violence, coercion, and bribery in their effort to harm our church. In Poland, 350 of our churches have been reduced to just 50. The remainder were converted to the Roman faith or just shut down entirely. The Polish government has engaged in the persecution of our clergy there. End quote. Now, the quotes about the newly created or recreated Polish state is a bit random. The war had just ended in the spring of 1921, and it delayed the establishment of Soviet power in large parts of Ukraine for the result of it. It doesn't mention the establishment of autocephaly for the Orthodox Church in Poland from the Patriarch of Antioch, which is an odd thing for him not to mention. But the GPU probably would not be aware of that anyway. He doesn't explain why these churches are being closed. So the section is very highly suspect. It's common amongst American Orthodox to refer that we're against politics. And it's a cop-out. The fact is that Orthodox politics has been set down in the Old Testament and in the political theory of the great Orthodox nations and empires from Byzantium to Russia. Since none of that is respectable in American neocon or conservative politics, they have to just reject, just cop-out and say we're not going to talk about politics at all. And yet, you can't separate justice and political action from the church. That's a heresy. You're saying that somehow Christ hasn't come to save those things. Just things that are easy to talk about and convenient. So it's not just falsehood, it's heresy. Because you're saying there's certain things that Christ didn't bother to save or to redeem. And then, of course, in this so-called testament, he comes out and says that there is no such thing as persecution of the Orthodox in Russia. And he says we have full freedom of conscience and we can preach, we can do whatever we want. The claims of our enemies are lies and fabrications. We denounce them. Now, this is comical. This is classic Soviet propaganda. But the GPU, the Cheka, always used that kind of language. Key words here that he's used in this are denounce, fabrications and lies, fantasies, and of course, enemies of the people. All of these are in this so-called testament. But there's only a rare communist document of this era that doesn't contain these precise words, these phrases, this kind of rhetoric. In July of 1923, the forger, claiming to be Saint Tikhon, states that he strongly dissociates himself from both foreign and domestic monarchist and white guardist counter-revolutionary movements. You gotta be kidding me. You know, this is really the product of the Supreme Court of the Soviet Union in a case that's concluded on June 16th of 1923. This is where it comes from. Now, Metropolitan Peter, at the time, he privately spoke of some of these coercive messages and how terrible, you know, what kind of forgeries they are. And he says this. He says, please don't pay attention to these things. They're done for internal reasons. People we know on the inside, of course, this guy's in exile, tell us about the horrid conditions the patriarch is forced to endure. He cannot escape it. He might publicly say to submit to the Soviets, but always privately tells us to reject it. Since it's an atheist regime dedicated to the destruction of the church, he could not possibly have accepted it. Now, chances are Metropolitan Peter really doesn't know. We know he was tortured in prison, so Tikhon could just put his name on anything. And may not even have been sane at the time, you know, because they practiced things like sleep deprivation and all that stuff. But the facts are different, of course. Tikhon was in regular correspondence with the Synod abroad, and with the Finnish and Latvian diplomatic courtiers were bringing some of his messages to them secretly out of the country. So even if Tikhon did sign, he didn't write those things, because it's not his writing style, obviously. But even if he did sign them, it was done under the most extreme duress. But the worst part is that this has been accepted as Tikhon's writings for a long time, and the OCA and liberal groups and American Orthodoxy every once in a while will trot these out, even today, saying how Tikhon supported the New Order. So it's phrases like fanatical white guardist, it's only that the Soviets use that kind of language. Let's talk about Sergius. Metropolitan Sergius, on February 15th, 1930, 14 years he will be made patriarch, gave a press conference to Soviet journalists. He had been a bishop in Finland for a while. Sergius gave almost the identical answers to foreign journalists as he did to internal journalists. He was asked the question, does there really exist in the USSR persecution of religion, and in what forms does it manifest itself? And this guy says there's been no persecution. Due to the decree of separation of church and state, the profession of any faith is fully free, and it's not persecuted by any state organ. Moreover, the last resolution of the TIK and SNK by religious organizations of the 8th of April, 1929, completely excludes even the slightest semblance of any persecution of religion. Which, of course, means he really doesn't answer the question. This might be a very clever way of avoiding it, because all he says is that it's written on paper that you can't persecute the church. Well, so what? He's not saying that it didn't happen. He just says we know it didn't happen because it was written down on paper that it didn't happen. You know, take a minute and figure out that he's saying it does happen. It's just not official. Not written on paper, anyway. But then he also says that, yeah, some churches are being shut down, but not because of the government, because the people want them shut down. It's all slander and speculation, he said. Remember something. The term conscience, Sovietsi, in Russian, it's a lot more than just an internal moral judgment that we all have. It's the meeting of the heart and mind, that entity where cognition and feeling come together. It's the heart, really. And it's related to the heart. The two terms are related. And a similarity also to the word Soviet. Sovietsi may have been chosen on purpose. And of course, in these forgeries, and some of the things that, you know, I don't, Metropolitan Sergius, you know, I'll talk about him in a little bit. I don't want to join in the chorus condemning him, because he was treated the same way that the Tikhon was. We'll talk about that in a minute. I said this before, and this new book I have coming out is going to say this over and over again, but it is laughable to say that the West supported the White Armies. About maybe a full third of this new book is going to prove, and I've said it on this radio show and a million other places, that the West supported the Reds, not the Whites. The Reds could have been smashed by the British Army right in Petersburg early on, and they refused. In fact, they were ordered not to, the Japanese as well, because they were deep into Siberia at one point. They could have very easily smashed the Red Armies by forcing them to split into two, one to the east, one to the west, but they were told to stand down or terrible things would happen to them. So it's ridiculous to claim that. Now, occasionally someone will say that the French government recognized Wrangel's state, and therefore, and it also accepted white refugees. But remember, this had no relation to anti-communism, but rather that Wrangel had the treasury of the Russian Empire stowed away in Swiss banks. Since so much of the capital in Russia was owned by the French, this was seen almost as a tribute or a premium to begin paying the debts that the Reds had repudiated. Repudiated with impunity, by the way. On the other hand, the immigration law in France was amended to say even a traffic ticket or mild citation was sufficient to repatriate. So a lot of that is mythological. It's almost totally unknown that in the refugee camps after the Russian Civil War, in the Balkans and in Germany, the local authorities forced everyone to liquidate their holdings at home at bargain basement prices in exchange for any food aid while in exile. I'm pretty sure I'm the first guy to say this in English, but it's true. In Turkey, for example, where a lot of exiles went, a whole separate market was established. It was called the Bazaar for Russian Refugees Property. Starting in 1924, France, Germany, and Italy banned all Russian doctors, accountants, or lawyers from working within their borders. And one of many insults to Russians, the Versailles Conference, the accursed Versailles Conference, did not recognize the Imperial Russian delegation, even though many millions of Russians died fighting Germany. The capitalist West was far more effective than the Cheka in destroying the Russian opposition. The Russian emigration that did have money at one point was now penniless and powerless. The White Army was disarmed, dissolved, and hounded out of existence through poverty and lack of employment. This is certainly a strange way for the West to deal with anti-communists. I thought money talked. They had money. Well, not anymore. They sold it back to the Soviet government. So even the tremendous money that the Whites had wasn't enough to change the West's mind. So fanatical were they in supporting the Red. Remember, too, the West had no idea what Russian monarchism was. They had no idea what Marxism or Bolshevism was. Even the intellectuals didn't. But at the same time as this is going on, millions of dollars of investment and aid money from these same Western powers was pouring into the USSR. Remember, in the 30s and afterwards, Francisco Franco in Spain came under intense Western sanctions, while Stalin was receiving aid and investment. To believe that the West was nothing if not pro-Marxist, statist, and pro-Soviet, and that myth can only come from constant repetition. They could have no other source. Franklin Roosevelt, really acted as Stalin's PR operator in America. FDR talked about Uncle Joe all the time, and he stated, you know, the Soviet image in the West would be improved if you disbanded the Comintern and provided some evidence of religious freedom. It's really all we asked for. The result of that was that Stalin ordered his kept bishops to create your own Vatican, he said. That was the revitalization of the Patriarch under Sergius and the communist institution called the Council for the Affairs of the Russian Orthodox Church, Karoc, or C-A-R-O-C. It was a direct creation of Stalin, but no input from any hierarchy or any church whatsoever. And it was to facilitate the connection between the NKVD on the one hand and the ROC on the other. Kalkanjiva, one of my favorite writers on this topic who opened my mind to a lot of things, she writes the following. Parallel with Decree number 1325, November 28, 1943, which allowed the Council of People's Commissars of the USSR to reopen Orthodox churches, Molotov ordered Karpov not to grant such permission without the preliminary sanction of the state. From 43 to 45, believers submitted almost 6,000 requests for church openings. Only 414 were granted. So enough of this pro-Stalin stuff. I've dealt with it on this show. I have essays on it. Stalin was no different than Lenin and Trotsky in this issue. This church had limited utility during the war, but it just meant that fewer priests were being slaughtered than more. And of course, as soon as the war was over, that changed. Kremlin archives were opened. American academics looked like fools. I mean, they usually look like fools, but in this case, it was right in front of their face. No one lost their job, as you would expect, because they were just spouting mythology the whole time, and still are. But it changed everything. Now, to his credit, Sergius did reject Stalin's request to permit married bishops, so he could have more, you know, his people be happier taking that job. At least they could be married openly. The first thing that they did, and one of the most embarrassing things, inviting Bishop of York in the Anglican Church, a guy named Cyril Garnet, who headed the mission to the USSR from the Anglicans. He didn't want to serve with Orthodox clergy, but it didn't come from any rejection of ecumenism. He was a fanatical ecumenist. But due to the undying hatred of the English for anything Russian, But he wrote a book called The Truth About Religion in Russia, and it was one of the most idiotic things you'll ever read. He argued that the only reason the church was liquidated in the 1920s was because they were all monarchists, and therefore they should be liquidated. Now, he says, under Stalin, a new church is being reborn. And the BBC aired this as well. They even created a miniseries romanticizing Stalin as the religious leader of the Russian church. And the MI6 beamed this into Eastern Europe as a way to prevent any rebellion against him. The Patriarch of Alexandria wrote this. The Orthodox Patriarch, Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Alexandria in Egypt said this. It must not be thought that the restoration of the Moscow Holy Synod is a political device imposed by circumstance. On the contrary, it is due to an unspoken declaration of the national faith. Long before the dissolution of the Third International, the Orthodox Church had assumed its rightful place in Russia. You might want to know that since the end of World War I, the Orthodox Church in Greece was totally broke. In the Middle East, of course, they had absolutely no money. The only place they could possibly go to for any funds was the Soviet Union. And that would explain this idiotic, stupid statement from this man. Not to mention the Anglican propaganda effort to support Stalin. Stalin wasn't considered a bad guy at the time. He was considered another Trotsky. Now, Soviet documents today show that this was written by the MI6, who controlled Egypt at the time. And also, as I've said many times, there was never any Cold War. And the West, more often than not, served the protector of, of Soviet interests, not their fighter. Of course, it's this new church that Stalin created was just a political matter. They had no religious power. They were, you know, they all had to support the new order of the Soviet Union. And these jurisdictions, who knew that they were lying, they need to address this publicly. And they're not, but they need to. These bishops knew they were lying. The Patriarch of Alexandria knew he was lying. But subsidies that were paid from Moscow to the Middle East, which is, by the way, in pounds, not in rubles or dollars, were very large. And what it did was create an isolated, corrupt clerical elite among the Orthodox churches in the Middle East and even parts of Europe. And that was Tucker's thesis in 1971. You had a very small group of Greeks in Antioch and Alexandria, totally dependent on Soviet money, funneled through the MI6. And that's how they functioned at all. One of the important conduits of Soviet dominance over the Orthodox seas outside of Russia was Princess Irina of Greece. April 10th, 1945, Stalin met with Patriarch Alexei and laid out a plan for capturing the Orthodox world outside of the Russian state, outside of the Eastern Bloc. Now, he used this victor over fascism title as a major part of this movement. There's minutes of this meeting that still exist. I'd been hidden for a long time. And Alexei was using canonical arguments to take all authority away from Constantinople, which was Stalin's drive at the time. And Stalin's directive to create an Orthodox Vatican was the idea to have this purely secular institution to fool the Orthodox world in Greece and elsewhere, that Stalin somehow was a religious ruler. And that was really the purpose of Kara. And they created this idiotic argument that was actually created at this very meeting in April of 45, that canonical orthodoxy means recognition by Moscow or Constantinople. So that's where this ridiculous argument comes from. It was successful in Transcarpathia, for example, Western Ukraine, Czechoslovakia, Poland. This propaganda coming from the MI6, well, the British can't be pro-communist, right? You know, they're English. How could they be? Not realizing this, well, they must be right. And so they gave away large chunks of Orthodox territory to the Soviet Union, think they're doing a good thing. Of course, none of these have any canonical validity whatsoever. But obviously, you know, one reason, not the least reason, that it was just Stalin's foreign policy. So recognition of this Stalinist sect, so-called the Moscow Patriarchate today, is based exclusively on financial pressure. Any anti-Soviet church was called fascist. You're supposed to be scared. But the Western media was even more enthusiastic about this concept than even the Soviet media was. Whenever tradition or the truth got in the way, the bishops would call on Kerouac for assistance. They'd put pressure on the offending party or the government, you know, foreign government like Poland, whatever. Then they'd fear for their lives, do whatever Moscow wanted. Soon the entire Orthodox world seemed unified around their Russian Marxist pope. Those dissenting were called non-canonical. So this is the whole notion. This is where Skoba comes from. Unbeknownst to a lot of those guys. But this whole canonical idea of recognition, which is never, never known in Orthodoxy before, comes from that one meeting that year in April. And this is really what Kerouac, which most Orthodox people never heard of before, that's the purpose. Metropolitan Dionysius of Poland, a man who I respect very much, he's one of the new martyrs of the Soviet yoke. He was also in Hitler's camps for a while. These bishops under him condemned, he was a Russian, by the way, this larger Ukrainian church in Poland, condemned Stalin's new sect, and the bishops that were Stalin's men essentially wearing cassocks. They claim, though, the Russians claim that autocephaly can only come from Moscow. The 1924 Tomos, giving them autocephaly, autonomy, came from both Constantinople and Antioch. Stalin's new Kerouac Universal Orthodox Papacy declared it null and void. It's nonsense, of course, that the argument doesn't make any sense. But Dionysius was a victim of this. And of course, they spread rumors that he was a Nazi agent. He was in Dachau, but he was a Nazi agent. This is how bad it was. And the MI6 was a huge part of it. 1949, the Polish Minister of Justice, Siemiatkowski, I guess, was summoned by Kerouac to Moscow. The plan was unhatched that the Polish church, which was Ukrainian, would have his tomos revoked, then granted a new one, an identical one, from Moscow. Almost an identical one. The church then was purged of all nationalists and forced under Moscow. Then, of course, considered autonomous by world orthodoxy. Immediately, Patriarch Maximus V was given a check for $50,000 American, which in 1949 was a tremendous sum. He shut his mouth. Another example is Metropolitan Seraphim Lyukhanov. He became the successor to Metropolitan Avlogius under Constantinople, and he soon came under Moscow. Seraphim was former Russian in exile, the exile group. He was a bishop for them. He had been smeared with, they were collaborationists with Hitler. Like, this is a big problem. Of course, the alternative would be collaboration with Stalin, and that was okay. But people were very sensitive to the smear because they knew what would happen to them. He was seen as vulnerable. And for this reason, because he was, you know, rightfully scared to death, he was chosen by Kerouac and Stalin, Moscow, to be the next leader of the ROC in the West. This poor soul was forced to say the following. The Orthodox Ecumenical Church goes beyond national frontiers. Within this vast Orthodox Ecumenical Church, our Russian church must occupy an honorable place as a mother of its people and protector of other Orthodox churches asking its support, especially the churches of the Slavs near to us. While calling us to him, the Patriarch allows us Christian liberty. We may believe and profess our faith freely. He binds us by no political obligations. We may be subjects of any country and live in it. This poor man. We can't judge these people, so we know what would happen to them if they didn't do this. In exchange for this garbage that he was forced to say, Seraphim was assured that all accusations for being a collaborator would disappear. It's also worth noting that it also meant that the Western newspapers would also drop the accusation. But how can that be? How would that permit Western journalists to stop talking about this issue? Unfortunately for Stalin, the Orthodox, the Russian church in Paris, a very large one, voted for Metropolitan Vladimir over Stalin's appointee. And of course, this is what would lead to the failure of the Moscow Patriarchate in Western Europe. But the power of the newly created CIA, MI6, Soviet intelligence, having been cooperating for a long time after World War II, continued to cooperate to make sure that fascism could never rear its head under Russian guise. As I've said on here many times, Metropolitan Anastasi was not only a national socialist, but he saw, at least in secular terms, Hitler as a harbinger of something new, social justice, something very good, something very positive. It wasn't just being a hammer against Hitler. This is what he wanted for Russia as well. It's often been argued that religion, in quotes, religion was persecuted in the USSR. Usually religion, because it's so vague, it's really just a code word for Christianity. That's all they're talking about. Being against organized religion, saying this in America or England or Russia, just means you don't like Christianity. There's a book called Religion, State, and Politics in the Soviet Union and Successor States in 1994. John Anderson cites official and non-official statistics to say otherwise. The height of Khrushchev's repression of orthodoxy between January of 58 to his overthrow in 1964. And he deals mostly with institutions closed, mostly parishes. But of course, the Orthodox Church was the sole target of repression. It went from 13,000 parishes to 7,500 in 1964 by hand. And that was all, of course, done by command. Most of these parishes were not functional. It simply took too much work to shut them all down. They shut down the ones that posed any kind of a threat. Peter the Great had done the same thing. Other churches, other religious groups saw only token repression. The Roman Church had, 1,244 parishes. And they were brought down to just over 1,000, mostly in the West and the Baltics. So 16% of their parishes were shut down. The Lutherans gained a parish from 451 to 452 in the same period of time. Of course, the Jews had absolutely no closures. But because of the immigration to Israel on the one hand, Asia, as we talked about on this show before, the Baal Zedong phenomenon, they went from 135 synagogues to 92. But that had nothing to do with repression. That was just how Jews were moving around. There were no repressions against Mormons, Moluccans, Baptists, even the old believers. You really can't have any accurate statistics there because they never would respond to any census. But the Muslims did see about 100 mosques closed. And all other sects, about 22%, and all other sects saw no repression whatsoever. And, non-Orthodox closures of churches can be explained through different motives, though. Islam to control the Central Asian republics, Jews for the issue of Zionism, the Armenians worried about nationalism. That none of these were religious issues. The Orthodox alone were destroyed by being Russian and Orthodox at the same time. The Darwinian materialist Marxists saw this as a deadly combination. One of the strategies in the 1960s to destroy Orthodoxy was to remove priests from any close connection to the parish. They were to be removed from any social or financial aspect of church life. So in 1960, early 61, the Moscow Church called a sacred synod at Zagorsk. They decreed that priests were to be removed from any social aspect of church life, which is the exact same language that you found in the KGB document. So if you read the KGB document saying we're going to remove priests from financial and social elements of life, this so-called Zagorsk Synod in 1960 simply cuts and pastes the KGB demand and puts it into their sacred synod. It's tragic, it's comic. But this is what's been what's going on, and at the time, what was completely accepted. Now listen, I said it before, I'm going to say it again. I'm not judging the clergy that signed these documents. I don't believe Tikhon wrote any of that stuff at the time. I think I've proved that just by reading it. But consider this. I mean, these guys had the threat of gulag camps, starvation, and torture, not just for them, but for their parishes and families too. They'd seen this happen. They knew it could happen to them. So you conform, at least in public, or you freeze to death on the White Sea. How many of you would sign the documents? Most Americans, the author included, would have done the same, because our wives and children would be sent to the taiga. Let me tell you something. When I hear these comfortable suburban Orthodox condemn the traitors and apostates in the Soviet Union, let me tell you something. You guys would be waving the hammer and sickle if their Volvo was being threatened. They'd sell their priest up the river if their credit score would go down maybe by a point if they didn't. Of course, the church had no validity, but their personal decisions, they're truly Orthodox and not just bureaucrats. They're understandable and rational. Very few of us would see our parishioners, our families, be sent to the camps because we had to stay hardcore. These guys signed a document, and that was enough, at least for a time, to be left alone. Most of you, I say all of the people listening to this, would have done the same. So do not condemn these people. We don't like what they did. We don't like what came of it. But we would have all done the same, and we could rationalize it very easily. 1975, Father Gleb Yekun and Lev Rigelson, they addressed the Nairobi meeting of the World Council of Churches. That organization exists solely from the Rockefeller Foundation and Western corporate capital. The speech of the group was ironic. They asked why this body, piously condemning every injustice in the world, usually imaginary, but some real, would make one exception, the persecution of the Orthodox Church and the USSR. Of course, they received no answer, but they were condemned immediately by the so-called Russian Orthodox Church present there. But for all of this, the Communist Party complained about an Orthodox revival as early as 1970. And worse, the new generation of believers were far better educated than the ones prior. Now, you can think what you want about Orthodoxy, but when you have millions of members sent to the camps, when a word or a phrase could get not just you, but your family and friends sent to the camps, and by 1970 you have a massive revival of the church, that tells you something. It tells you something about the truth of Orthodoxy. Now, even the best of scholars has to remark that Western pressure influenced Soviet policy and religion, but they can't provide any real documentation. They try to say that Stalin and these guys were a little bit easier on Orthodoxy than before. Western governments forced them to do it. I haven't seen a single document saying this. Closest I've come, I've quoted already, where you have, you know, FDR saying, hey, you know, just don't kill that many of them, and maybe, you know, you'll have better press in the West. It wasn't the problem that they were dead. It was just that they didn't like the PR problems that were too much for him. There isn't a single document where a Western government, a Western entity of any kind, put pressure on the USSR to be nicer to the Orthodox people there. To this day, and I'm telling you, I if someone has an answer, I want to hear it. Why is the Russian Church, the Moscow Patriarchate, still in the World Council of Churches? Vladimir Putin is a big fan of it, but there is nothing in his ideological background, in his speeches, the people who support him and vote for him, that wants anything to do with this globalist body. Putin has been the sole warrior in world politics against the New World Order, except in this one area. The current patriarch of Moscow, his entire experience and education comes from the WCC in the West. They practically raised him. Lukashenko is the same in Belarus. They fight the New World Order in every possible way except the World Council of Churches. The best that I could come up with is that this is a way to propagandize the West about their agenda, about Putin, and making Putin seem better, at least in a religious arena. But by now, he realizes that it's failed. The West doesn't care about religion, except as a secular phenomenon. And yet he's still a part of it. I don't understand. because his own base, his voting base in Russia, hates this kind of Western-created Rockefeller internationalism. This is what destroyed the country in the 90s. These people backed and supported Marxism from day one. Why he's still a member of the World Council of Churches and has his church, you know, the Moscow Patriarchate, as a member, I simply don't understand. Maybe there's a financial connection here. Remember, in the 1990s, the Jewish oligarchs shipped out billions and billions of rubles, dollars, actually, worth of capital, whether in liquid form or capital that became liquid, to banks in Switzerland, the Caribbean, New York. And it's been a preoccupation, as it would be for any of us, to try to get some of that back to Russia. Well, since the World Council of Churches is financed by the Rockefellers, you know, Ford Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, very liberal Protestant churches in the West, there's a lot of corporate money coming in and out of that place. Putin probably knows more about that than we ever could. And that he sees that that's a way to get some of that money back. I don't know the details, but it would make sense, at least in general, that in using this as a backdoor to talk to the Rockefellers and getting a few of those rubles back, well, it's really his responsibility. He has to do that. I don't know. But I'm telling you one thing. The West supported the USSR and openly denied to this very day that the Orthodox Church was repressed. Now, it's becoming harder and harder to do that anymore, because in the late 90s, most of the documents that were hidden in the archives of the Kremlin were made public. And it showed that the books written on the USSR prior to that were useless. Please don't read books on the USSR, with a few exceptions, prior to the 1990s, because they were written before all of this evidence was unearthed. And you shouldn't take that very seriously. And guys like, you know, Tucker and a few of these guys who did a good job talking about the Holodomor and things like that, you know, they did a good job on that. Even Daniel Pipes, a neocon, but he did a good job in talking about some of the repressions. That's true. But without these documents, you know, they're talking about maybe a quarter of the evidence that was available to them. But one of the things that these documents show is overt Western support for the Soviet Union. The Patriarch of Ukraine, Vladimir, his legitimate canonical background, like it or not, who was in the Gulag for a while, in one of his letters to the World Council of Churches, he condemns them openly, saying, "You guys have been enablers of the Soviet system. I've been writing to you, talking to you about the destruction of the church over here, and you have said absolutely nothing. You've yawned." The only time there was ever any outrage about treatment of a religious group was when the Jews were forbidden to emigrate to Israel. The U.S. Congress erupted in indignation. But for the millions of Orthodox slaughtered from 1921 on, you had a collective yawn so great that there'd be a blackout due to the excess carbon monoxide in the air. The WCC is a religious wing of corporate America. Corporate America and WCC was the Soviet mouthpiece in the West. Therefore, it doesn't take a genius to come to that conclusion. Any time an Orthodox person would talk about nationalism, it was crushed. And that destruction was not only either denied or applauded in the West. As always, nationalism and nationalism alone is the sole and exclusive enemy here. The only time you had a Cold War with the Soviet Union was when nationalism came into the picture. Détente, for example, was not the cause of the Soviet easing up on persecution. Détente, as we all know now, was a Soviet plea for some space to rebuild and for greater aid from the West. Their economy was struggling, And Western corporations struck deals with Moscow for lower grain prices. Archer Daniels Midland was one of the big go-betweens, American capital on the one hand, the Soviet government on the other hand, who, by the way, was one of the main financiers of the World Council of Churches. And in fact, the former president of the WCC was the former chairman of the board for Archer Daniels Midland. These are not coincidences. The fact that what I'm saying here is almost completely unknown to so-called scholars in this field in American universities, and that the crap that these people were peddling, that's been completely exposed by these new documents that have been translated and discovered from the mid-90s onward, says that they have been just completely fraudulent people. No one's lost their job. No one has been mocked as they deserve to be, but because they have not changed their point of view with these new revelations. The greatest open secret of our era, the 20th century and the 21st, is that Western governments built the Soviet Union. They defended the Soviet Union. They created the Soviet Union. There is no aspect of the USSR that was not created by the West. And the Western world defended, denied, and covered over the slaughter of Orthodox people from the beginning. And all of this information is now public knowledge, and nothing is being said about it. And it shows you that the American academic, the American intellectual on these issues is a total and complete fraud. Anyway, that is my talk here on this extremely important issue. Some of this stuff has been uttered for the first time in English here. And so I appreciate you listening. And as far as my enemies are concerned, I really wish that you're listening on into this. You know, you guys, anybody, you know, any elite organizations listening, monitoring these things, well, you're welcome to do so, because this is probably the first time you're being properly educated in your lives. So please, listen in on this stuff. I have no problem with it. The first time you guys are hearing truth for the first time in your miserable little existences. Anyway, to my friends, thank you very much for your support, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.